Welcome to the Retail Focus Podcast, a weekly collection of news, interviews, and information from the world of retail. Here are your hosts, Trent Kling and Leighton Kling.
Welcome to this edition of the Retail Focus Podcast with Trent and Leighton Kling. Coming up on today's show, we'll talk Amazon because we have to. We're a retail podcast. But after we talk about Amazon, we'll get to some things we really wanted to delve into, including Simon Property Group, love the real estate part of retail. We'll also talk about MasterCard and how payments continue to change in the retail setting. And Tuesday morning releases earnings. We'll update you on their attempt at a comeback story. So earnings season, that's kind of the theme of today's podcast. A reminder to like us and rate us however you do access us. But we will begin today's show with Amazon. And again, it's a story basically we have to cover because the name of the podcast is the Retail Focus Podcast. Everyone was paying attention to Amazon last week. Shares fell over 5% on Friday after investors worried about 2019 growth and company reinvestment. Even though Amazon put millions back into new and existing projects in 2018, reinvestment was proportionately slower, and now Leighton, the company plans for a full-on global assault, but that's going to take loads of cash.
It certainly is, and if you talk about 2018, you do have to talk about the fact that they did take a backseat in terms of reinvestment activity, and this is something that Amazon has been known for since the beginning of Amazon, is always reinvesting cash into new areas of their business or areas that they think are going to be growth sectors, and really not being afraid of taking risks. Risks are important if you're an up-and-comer, especially in the e-commerce space, especially with AWS. That was a major bet, and that bet ended up turning out to be a huge win for the company. But you fast forward to 2018, they did slow down a little bit, but I don't know what investors or analysts were thinking. Were they thinking they were all of a sudden going to be issuing a dividend because they are now profitable? I would think not. So logic would have you believe that the company is going to continue as normal for 2019, and reinvestment is going to be key. So while shares did fall over 5% on Friday after that investment worry, you do have to look at it from sort of a bird's eye view. How is the business performing, and how are they going to dominate, particularly in retail, because we are the Retail Focus Podcast, for the rest of 2019? And a lot of what we have to say here, Trent, has to do with the global economy, how different areas of the world are performing, and what strategies are Amazon going to employ, the executives looking at, in order to gain market share into a number of different territories. And they talk about regulation concerns, particularly in India, an area which we see a lot of investment, particularly from Walmart with that partial Flipkart acquisition. But first, we bring it back to the latest quarter. Again, this was for their fourth quarter earnings. Revenue was largely a function of breaking those holiday sales estimates. Surprised management in a good way. That revenue, of course, includes AWS income as well as other sources beyond retail. They talk about advertising being a bet that actually paid off for them. They brought in a total of $72.4 billion. That's billion with a B in revenue for this latest quarter. Earnings per share hit $6.04 on roughly $3 billion in net income. That is a lot of money the company is churning out. Revenue was $12 billion greater than 2017's fourth quarter, and earnings per share nearly doubled. As far as beating analyst expectations, they did just that on both of those key figures. They topped earnings per share estimates by a larger percentage than revenue, but impressed nonetheless. AWS, or Amazon Web Services, as those like to say out there, say the whole term rather than just the acronym, continued to be Amazon's profit center and their growth engine. The cloud computing arm reported sales growth of around 45% to around $7.43 billion from around $5.11 billion. And operating income increased 61%. And this is the key figure that everyone keeps looking at because they're saying that, yes, we know that AWS has a clinch on the market. They take up so much market share and they're expanding. However, because of other players in the cloud space. Think of Microsoft. Think of IBM. You tend to think that margins are going to come down over time. That is not the case. You look at that operating income, they are not only performing better in terms of retaining and increasing that market share, but they're doing more in a more efficient manner. So all of those people, including us, by the way, last year saying that constantly changing out those servers is going to end up affecting their bottom line, we are not seeing it just yet. So again, despite strong sales and profit marks, again, looking at the company as a whole here, the company's shares didn't represent favorable investor reaction. We look at that soft guidance for fiscal first quarter, and I think a lot of that does have to do with potentially a little bit of a slowing down in revenue from that retail side of the business. A lot of people are saying that, well, there are some geopolitical woes. The government did just shut down, so people may not be spending as much online. Those are real concerns that could affect the top line for Amazon. However, still looking at guidance that indicates positive revenue figures in terms of year-over-year management. And speaking of management, they said that prior investments are what made 2018 such a strong year in the first place, sort of trying to remind everybody, those analysts, those investors, those podcasters, including us, that all of their current success has to do with prior investments, prior thinking about long-term needs for the company. So they're saying specifically, investments and outlook between 2015 and 2017 is what made the fourth quarter, this quarter, so great.
And one of the things that they also mentioned is the fact that there's going to have to be a lot of investments when it comes to their new headquarters. And we knew that a new headquarters was going to be right around at least $4 billion. So to be taken aback if you're an investor or an analyst when you're reiterating some of those hiring figures for the New York and D.C. offices seems a little bit unnecessary, or as the kids say, seems a bit extra here when we're talking about Amazon. Now, we both have talked about on the show in the past, look, you know Amazon is going to be a big retailer, but they're just not going to be all that profitable because they are reinvesting so much money and because the cost of every customer is a little bit higher for Amazon, and that is something to watch for going forward. Meanwhile, we've talked about AWS, we've talked about their online retail. What about their brick-and-mortar retail? Well, amid anecdotal evidence of continued price breaks at Whole Foods, we're seeing actually softness on this side in brick-and-mortar sales for Amazon. And again, I want you all to think back to when this purchase was announced, when Amazon announced that they were buying Whole Foods. Remember how Kroger lost nearly one-third of their market cap within the span of just a couple of days because people were saying Amazon's going to take over grocery, and their purchase of Whole Foods, who, by the way, held less than 2% of the grocery market share in the U.S. and still hold less than 2% of the grocery market share in the U.S., people thought that that was going to be the end of traditional grocery. Well, that has not been the case. And in fact, Amazon reported that sales in physical stores fell 3% in the fourth quarter from the prior year, from $4.52 billion to $4.4 billion. And it's not like we're seeing wholesale store closures, so this leads us to believe certainly that same-store sales are not going in a positive direction for Whole Foods. And we should remind listeners as well that beyond Whole Foods, Amazon also operates a few physical bookstores and convenience stores, but the number of Whole Foods stores far outnumbers the number of Amazon's other investments, at least in terms of that revenue that they're bringing in. Amazon also opened some pop-up stores around the holidays to sell gifts in popular categories online, some of those five-star stores we've talked about before. We remember back to the last few quarters Whole Foods had as a publicly traded company. Again, same-store sales struggled. They weren't necessarily heading in a negative direction, but they were pretty well even, pretty well stagnating for a company that was supposed to be in a growth phase. And the company, we said going forward, would be lucky to have positive comp guidance even with Amazon's influence. And there was, just so everyone knows, an adjustment to the number of days included in the Whole Foods fiscal quarter to line up with Amazon. So this did take 5 days off of sales, but not really enough to count for that large of a fall off when you consider Amazon's other additions in terms of brick and mortar. Now, jumping back to the e-commerce side, and I should mention as far as wrapping up the brick and mortar side, we don't know where things are going for Whole Foods. It seems like Amazon's trying a number of different solutions for them. So far, nothing sticks, but at least from the e-commerce side, things may be changing as far as the fee structure for third-party sellers. And again, a lot of the products moved on Amazon come from third-party sellers, so This is why you hear Amazon bring up things in terms of overall merchandise sold versus the overall revenue. There's a big difference between those two numbers because of the third-party sellers, which have been a bit more regulated by Amazon, and in our opinion, for valid reasons. Public safety being one of them, of course, but also an influx of counterfeit goods has created some consumer mistrust and has affected their brand in areas like health and beauty products in the past. Basically, this is a similar phenomenon to what we were seeing from Walmart about 3 years ago, where these third-party sellers were eroding their brand. Walmart, you could argue, had a bit more to lose because they did have that brick-and-mortar brand there. But Amazon, one of the things that they noted is they're going to have to do something about kind of reining in some of the third-party sellers and making sure that the goods offered on the website are quality to the consumer.
If there's one theme that you can sort of take away from management's comments during the earnings call for this latest quarter, you can really get the sense that they're saying that it will always evolve. And by evolve, we mean the relationship between them, the owners of the platform, Amazon, retail, and those third-party sellers. They say that is an extremely important relationship, but one that actually should be looked at constantly and evolve over time. We're not just talking in terms of the fee structure, we're talking in terms of all of the requirements that sellers have to go forward and try to fulfill. And so Amazon noted in its report that nearly 50% of sales on the platform came from small and medium-sized businesses. I love that. I love that transparency. And that really brings home the point that it's not Amazon necessarily that's selling a lot of their products, billions of dollars worth of merchandise over the internet. It's a lot of small businesses, mom and pop shops. Think about 12 years ago when eBay was the bee's knees. Everyone was trying to start their own eBay business. Well, Amazon is sort of that way now. Across the last 2, 3, 4 years, a lot of people are trying to make their own income solely off of Amazon and selling high commodity goods off of that platform. Because Amazon does so much business with third-party merchants, it does behoove them to keep a healthy relationship in order to keep them on the platform and happy. Because there are a lot of up-and-comers. Think of Etsy, and eBay is still around, but it is still extremely important to keep them happy and to keep them selling to their core customer. And management said approximately 30% of the gross merchandise volume from third-party sellers gets funneled to Amazon by way of fees. So it behooves all parties, really, and that you're employing these people, essentially, on contract, and in turn, you get 30% of that gross merchandise volume back in fees. That's how they make their money off of third-party sellers selling products on their platform. And while that seems like a lot are okay with paying those fees, obviously, when they have such a successful, curated business promoting in-demand items because of whatever they have going on the side, usually social media. Still, management said that fee adjustment still needs to be looked at. And again, it's going to be an ongoing issue for the company. And in the end, the power is still largely in the hands of Amazon, who, by the way, has massive, better than ever, fulfillment capabilities and that Prime platform that keeps people in the loop and keeps people wanting to buy more and more. And they have credit cards tied to that platform now. So I think it's going to be a main concern for those third-party sellers. What can they do to sort of leverage their power, especially those sellers that sell the most items on Amazon, to really convey the best, most favorable terms for their particular business to Amazon executives?
Well, let's move on to the part of the show that Layton was looking forward to most, and that's discussing Simon Property Group, as they reported earnings as well on Thursday, also etching in some records for investors. Now, Simon owns many malls throughout the country. A lot of people know Simon as primarily a mall ownership group. And as a result, they've been looked at as a company most at risk for declining traffic and department store closures and all of this fatalistic talk about malls that we see in the media. Well, the firm reported earnings per share of $2.30 on revenue of $1.46 billion. Analysts had a forecast earnings per share of just $1.91. Very similar on revenue, though. Analysts had revenue pegged at $1.44 billion. So, Simon, a modest beat on revenue, but the 41% increase in earnings per share over last year, and, of course, the beat of analysts' expectations by a whopping 39 cents, is most notable here. And just to note here on our Instagram page, Leighton has been going out to a variety of malls, a few of them Simon properties there, taking pictures, putting them up on our Instagram page. And Leighton, I think you would back this up, that you have seen a lot of Simon malls have been reinvested in. So they're not the stagnant malls that you hear about, those B and C class malls in many cases that you do hear about. Now, they do have some of those properties, but enough properties are still doing stellar business for Simon to be able to boost up their numbers. And speaking of those numbers, let's dive into those and put their top line performance in perspective. Instead of being down on the challenges that retail real estate business has to offer currently, CEO David Simon called the changing times exciting. And keep in mind, this is one of the companies that got out in the forefront of when Sears was starting to close the stores. They said, hey, this might be a good thing for us. This is not necessarily exciting news that Sears stores are closing, but it's notable in that we can rearrange things in our real estate holdings because Sears is paying us below market average rents. And because Sears is doing that, we might be able to boost the amount of rents that we're getting from clients. We can reorganize the malls, shuffle things around so we don't have these enormous anchors, or if we do, they're focused on some other concepts. And while the company is transitioning many of its properties into a higher class or into mixed-use developments with some of those other concepts, the current metrics for the company are still stronger. In fact, very strong as of this earnings call. NOI increased 2.3% for the year. Again, we're talking about net operating income there. 2.1% particularly for the fourth quarter. So fourth quarter right in line with the rest of the year. They see NOI increasing by about 2% again for fiscal 2019. And again, as Leighton's talked about before, NOI, a crucial metric for those in the retail real estate sector. Year-end net income for Simon was up over 26% for the real estate group. Funds from operations, this was up 3.5% to $1.2 billion. Another strong number there. For the year as a whole, Simon saw a 5.3% increase in reported U.S. retailer sales per square foot to $661. That's a new record for the firm. So again, take all that you know from the media and from these kind of clickbaity, blown-out stories about malls failing. What Simon is seeing is actually quite different from the retailers that make up the sales floor space held in Simon properties, not just the closed malls, but of course the strip malls and other anchored shopping centers. Occupancy also held steady, finishing 2018 at 95.9%. You think of Simon again as a mall operator, that 95.9%, well above the national retail real estate occupancy average, and for them, that's a 30 basis point increase year over year, and even stronger sequentially, meaning that the vacancies they do have are being leased out at a decent pace. Finally, as of October last year, the mall occupancy rate was sitting at 90.9% in the U.S., which again, above the U.S. average. That's actually their lowest point for Simon in 7 years. This is, again, just looking at malls there, just looking at malls outside of their other anchor shopping centers that they have. But that all took place after Bon-Ton closures and Sears closures. So you kind of balance that out and you note that, yeah, that is the lowest point in 7 years, still above the national average, and it's coming right after a lot of these closures that Simon honestly believes they can fill those spaces. And that's why, you know, if I sound excited, it was quite honestly an exciting earnings call, not only for retail in the U.S., but more specifically, retail real estate in the U.S.
Absolutely. And again, to reiterate, we can't say enough how much we love talking about commercial real estate in the retail sector. And before I go on talking about the reporting in the general direction of the company, I did want to go and talk about David Simon, their CEO, a little bit. He's been on all of their quarterly calls for a long time now. If you go back into his history, he first began in real estate in 1990. So I wanted to say this to put this in perspective, in that he's been a leader at the very highest level. He actually was a CFO for Simon Property back in 1990. That's what he was hired on to do after a couple of years in the banking sector. And in 93, he led efforts to take Simon Property Group public with, by the way, the biggest IPO for a real estate investment trust. And we throw around that word all of the time now. REITs are everywhere, and we talked about several on this very podcast, but he was actually the first one to have a REIT disclosed at a $1 billion initial public offering. So he has a ton of experience. And so as I go in here and detail some of his remarks that he made during this latest quarter, he brings in a ton of experience and he tries to really tell the people listening in on these calls that, listen, I've seen it all. I've been through multiple transitions in this particular industry. We're not talking just real estate. That's fine. If somebody was a real estate investor or a broker previously in another life, in another sector, that's okay. But we're talking about retail commercial real estate. He has the majority of his career in, and by the way, a very strong finance background. So he can bring together those two. That dynamic really brings together or really brings to light the fact that management is in a strong place. And again, it really reassures those longtime investors, particularly those long-term investors that are trying to see a rate of return on their money based off of dividends. It really brings to light that they are safe and secure with holding this particular stock. But David Simon, again, for his part, reiterated on Friday saying that reclaiming department store space continues to be top priority for the company, but there's always been a change in their industry over the years. Also hinting to those that are listening, again, that there's going to be a successful adaptation for those particular shopping centers that are facing high vacancy rates. Those reporting on the direction of the company were hanging on the fact that management pointed out that the direction of many of their tenants is binary, basically saying that retailers are going to get stronger or weaker. And they said there's a clear trend that those that are already outperforming are going to continue to outperform, while those that are either filing for bankruptcy or on the brink of bankruptcy are going to be the weaker tenants going forward. But because they know that, they can better plan for the future. And I think that's extremely impressive for them to recognize that rather than just saying all is well and good. No, they're trying to pay attention to those retailers that are struggling from a very microscopic level. They did go on to say that a few of their new vacancies will be experienced in 2019, but it'll be temporary. They said to shareholders, again, that confidence instills the idea that they anticipate some of these closures. And again, they have plans in place. You think of Sears, you think of those Bon-Ton stores. They've already had plans in place. Something actually we talked about at the end of 2018 when we talked about a number of REITs and their plans moving forward to fill those spaces, particularly with multi-use facilities. And as far as big moves like GGP being acquired by Brookfield Property Partners, no plans are evident to change their current course of action within the company. So we're talking about either being acquired or acquiring other smaller entities that also participate in the commercial real estate space. Because we do know from our experience, at least researching from this very podcast, that across the last 2 to 3 years, those who dabble strictly in one particular facet of commercial real estate have been trying to sort of hedge their bet. So if they just focus on retail, they've been buying office or vice versa. So I think that's a very important point to bring home again, back to management, is that this is their core competency and they are sticking to it. So they're not, again, looking to be acquired or acquire anything in the near future. Of course, there are rumors out there, but management for their part has stayed quiet. That course involves slow but steady premium outlet mall expansion for their new future. And so they opened 2 new outlets in 2018. Again, part of their strategy, since they aren't looking to acquire any new projects, they're actually looking to build from within. I think this is a good strategy for them because the premium outlet collection that they currently have has done extremely well. They're looking for new outlets in Edmonton, Canada, Denver premium outlets, and construction continues, they said, on 3 new outlets in leading international markets, which is something they're looking forward to, is global expansion. Mexico, in particular, and Spain will open in the fall. They are boasting a more diversified income base, and they actually mentioned that malls, those conventional indoor malls that we tend to talk about here with Simon Property Group, brings in around 48% of revenue for the company. So about half of the revenue is from those older indoor malls. Outlet malls now bring in 42% of revenue, and international centers are now sitting at around 10% of revenue. So again, we're talking about hedging your bets here, hedging your bets internationally. International and premium outlets look to be the obvious picks for taking up a higher percentage of lease activity and therefore revenue going forward. A total of 25, they said. New opportunities are on the horizon. So while I talk about Mexico and Spain, they're looking towards other markets in Asia that they think expansion is going to be strong moving forward. And Trent, I am a fan of shopping centers. I spent about 3 hours of my workday today actually looking at shopping centers that have been open for the last couple of decades that are massive in relation to what we have here in the United States. So if any market is ripe for new opportunities, I would say anywhere in Asia, and some parts of Europe love their indoor shopping opportunities.
Well, you know, and we were talking even before we came on the air today about Edmonton and how much of a shopping mall-centric community Edmonton really is. Now, they do have a new district downtown that has a little bit more outdoor shopping, but you talk about something like the West Edmonton Mall that is just a fixture here in North America, and then you look at what Simon is doing with the Premium Outlet Collection in Edmonton. That is another market that's international that is also ripe in terms of adding on retail real estate in Simon's portfolio. And as you mentioned, Leighton, diversifying that portfolio away from not only the traditional mall holdings in the U.S., but also the outlet mall holdings in the U.S. Now, in order to pay for all of this development that we've talked about, they have to have a strong balance sheet, and that they do. They actually have $7.5 billion in liquidity as of year's end, and a net debt to EBITDA ratio of 5.1 times, both solid numbers for someone in this space. They're also using cash, some of this extra cash that they have, to buy back shares. In addition to building new malls and new structures, they bought back $47 million worth of shares in the fourth quarter alone. So again, Simon, a company that we generally like in terms of their operation, but we also like the way that they have adjusted their holdings as time has gone on, kept some of their malls from going stale, and the ones that are in danger of going stale, they're turning into some of those mixed-use developments that you're seeing more and more of in the retail real estate space. Well, coming up after the break, we're going to talk off-price with Tuesday Morning, who has been on the comeback trail. Could they continue it with this most recent earnings call? We'll also discuss payment processors with MasterCard.
Well, we're back with Tuesday Morning as they actually posted a profit for their second quarter earnings report and higher revenues thanks to a culmination of a number of plans. Those plans we've talked about over the last few months. But Tuesday Morning, trading under the ticker symbol TUES, has lost investor faith steadily over the last couple of years as shares have cratered to below $1.80. With recent positive news, however, shares trending up to over $2.45 a share. Prior to earnings coming out on Thursday, shares were hitting that $1.80 mark, but earnings per share, Trent, hit 35 cents versus the expected 29 cents per share. Surprising that analysts were expecting even that much of a profit because we were sort of taken back when we first got this press release, but revenue also up, around $5 million up over last year to $338 million. Comps, those same-store sales, 1.9%, also trending in a positive direction. We would like to see them a little bit higher because that is almost a dead match to inflation. CEO Steven Becker said that strong holiday season gave proof that their concept is strong and that the actions they've taken over the last couple of years have really stuck.
Gross margin for the company expanded 280 basis points, which is perhaps the biggest surprise to us, as well as it was seemed to be a surprise to the company's management. Keep in mind that Tuesday Morning, a retailer with relatively recent management turnover, so positive signs for the new management group that is in place, led, of course, by Steven Becker, that they were able to push out this margin to this extent. SG&A, or selling, general, and administrative expenses, deleveraged 50 basis points in the quarter. We've talked about their supply chain efficiencies at length in the past, but that's now bearing fruit as they've begun to kind of build out their supply chain, trying to reduce the number of empty shelves during high traffic times of the year. And part of this was also related to closing down certain stores, relocating certain stores to nicer, more expensive areas. All of that, the company feels, has helped their efforts. And we were kind of questioning the strategy a bit on the more expensive areas part because of those higher leasing costs. We didn't know if that was going to be a net gain for them. We agreed with some of the store closures that they had, with some of the older, stale stores under the prior Tuesday morning brand that they had really created. We liked the overall direction of their brand image, though, as a whole. And when Stephen Becker came on this call, they said they have a notable change in what they call sales density. Basically, this is individual store performance. They did open two new stores for the quarter, and what we always love with Tuesday Morning is the transparency in terms of their strategy pertaining to real estate. Not every retailer goes this in-depth on real estate on the calls. We just spent 15 minutes talking about Simon in the last story, so of course we love this aspect of it, but management said that over the next 12 months, approximately 25% of their store fleet comes up for renewal, and in an era where you're looking at 5 to 10 year leases, for 25% to come up in 1 year, that is a massive amount. One thing Tuesday Morning will be looking to do is aggressively negotiate rents and close stores opportunistically should those negotiations, and I quote, not result in a reasonable outcome for Tuesday Morning. Basically, what Becker is saying is they have a little bit of leverage here, not only because they feel like they can renegotiate leases to be more in Tuesday Morning's favor, but also they've developed a track record of not hesitating to move a store that they feel like is underperforming. So they can go into some of these underperforming stores in these lease negotiations with the landlord and say, hey, look, we've done this in other markets. We won't be afraid to do this here if we don't get the right deal. Now, regarding the brand, which we just alluded to here, the previous advertising spend has been expensive and, quite frankly, not worth it, something the company has referenced on earlier earnings calls. However, new digital ad campaigns with less in-store markdowns has been the key for them. So not including as much marketing as far as really publicizing some of those in-store deals, instead pushing to digital ad campaigns. I see a lot of Tuesday Morning ads. Now, granted, it's probably because Tuesday Morning shows up in my search history because we do this show, but still, you can see that Tuesday Morning is really working hard on the digital ad spend, and this works on two fronts here. Margin growth, because again, fewer in-store markdowns, and also brand elevation. It helps, too, that they have a logo that's actually consistent across all their stores. They're working to replace the old Tuesday Morning logo iterations because it was different basically every Tuesday morning that you visited. Some of them had that old, very classic Arial font. Some of them had a different font. Well, now, although we're not quite sold on the font that they're using currently, at least they're being consistent with it across all of their stores, across the labeling in the stores. And for Tuesday Morning, this has been a multi-year strategy to elevate the brand and make the brand consistent across their entire store fleet. And a lot of shareholders were kind of losing patience with this process. This is something that a lot of retailers strive for, but it's hard to execute on. But you fast forward to now, last week's earnings call, so where analysts were even congratulating them on the turnaround success, which is something that Leighton and I didn't think we would hear on an earnings call for a while, if ever, again, for Tuesday Morning. They're pretty blunt, Tuesday Morning is, about how they need to keep evolving with ad spend, how they're completely unimpressed with the amount of impressions they are getting or have gotten from traditional print media versus digital. That's why they continue to push towards digital. And even though this particular store doesn't have that robust e-commerce presence, they feel like that digital marketing is necessary to elevate the brand and drive home the brand, where before that just didn't really happen with that traditional print media.
It's funny, Trent, because a conversation you and I were just having before actually recording this podcast was just about how executives were so blunt to all of those analysts on the call several times, saying that they are totally unimpressed. They are unenthusiastic about the conventional means to relay their message to their core customer. They hate print media. Not only did they say that in the prepared remarks, they said that during the Q&A. The Q&A didn't even really have any questions based on traditional media, but they were asking about digital. But still, executives felt it necessary to really address the fact that they had far fewer impressions and they just did not have the positive response that they had in prior years. But fast forward now to another topic, one of the last topics we'll talk about here with Tuesday Morning. We're going to be talking about their product assortment, and it's looking to change a little bit more aggressively as the months go by in 2019, as they target families in different life cycle stages. And you have to kind of scratch your head and say, what's a life cycle stage? But they want to attract mature families, families that are in an older demographic, but then also families that are growing or at the beginning stages of getting settled into their home. And so they feel a certain level of confidence in that they can attract both of these different demographics in terms of product selection and combined marketing approach. Because if you think about it, a lot of people that are up there in years between the ages of 40 and 60 are on Facebook now. And so they're looking at ways to try to identify their audience and get their customers into their stores. And they feel as though they can span a number of generations in doing so. The call had such an optimistic tone. I hope that we weren't the only ones listening in, but it was so positive and it really rang through that some of the closing remarks made by the CEO really said they were on their way to long-term profitable growth. And so it's always reassuring because a company that's been failing to meet green at the end of their balance sheet or at the end of their income statement for so long, finally getting to this point, it would almost be tempting for the executive to say, you know what, we made it, we're done now. But they're looking at the long-term view and they want positive quarters. They want to be in the green every quarter thereafter now. So now in our view, we are somewhat surprised at the sudden turnaround for the company given all of the criticism in the past. And me personally, I know Trent's been bullish on the company, but I myself, if you were to ask me late 2017, is Tuesday Morning ever going to turn a profit again? I would have to say 50% no, 50% yes. It was sort of up in the air for me. So really not leaving such a positive tone for me, not really believing in their strategies as far as marketing and as far as trying to change how they play in the retail landscape and trying to identify higher rent spaces that are going to attract different demographics. We believe that while they continue to be profitable and even more profitable as they now head into 2019, overall top line growth, it may be a little too soon to see that's going to be outpacing inflation a whole lot. And I think a lot of that, Trent, has to do with the fact that they are still looking and they're being transparent about this. We're not breaking any secrets here. They are still looking to close down certain stores if those lease negotiations don't turn for the better. So they have a lot of store leases that are coming up. They're coming due in 2019. If those don't go well, it can either go one of two ways. You either re-sign at a higher lease rate that you didn't want to, or you exit entirely. And both of those are bad scenarios for Tuesday Morning. The good scenario would be that if they get a lower lease rate, they're able to capture a lower lease rate for a longer period of time. However, if they are going to hold steady and holding down other costs, and if lease negotiations go well, that is the one thing we could see for the bottom line of the company to really keep accelerating at a higher level than top line revenue. But again, I would be hung up on that top line revenue for a number of reasons. People love their products, and it's fascinating to me to see those loyal customers coming in every single week, not really being scared away by a higher price point. Because again, those weekly markdowns or monthly markdowns, as Trent talked to quite directly, those don't exist much anymore for the company. So as gross margin increased 280 basis points in the second quarter, again, to 34.5%, we really see that number holding true. And it's, again, interesting to see that those routine markdowns really not having an effect on customers coming in through the door. And it does seem like they are being able to drive a ton of traffic based on new ads. And toys, by the way, is a very last note for Tuesday Morning. Anecdotally, seem to be taking over a larger portion of the sales floor for them, which could, by the way, mean brand loyalty for an even younger demographic.
Well, on to our final story now in the form of MasterCard. MasterCard absolutely showed how everyone is transitioning to cashless transactions with their 15% increase in revenue growth for their latest reportable quarter. Now, MasterCard and Visa have been put on the short list for years as mature, long-standing card companies that are fundamentally sound with massive growth potential for years to come. So they're both kind of that historically solid company, but also a company that has growth potential in the future. And when you look at MasterCard stock ticker MA, their stock price is up over 178% over the last 5 years, now holds a $222 billion market cap. Revenue for the behemoth hit $3.8 billion in quarter four, while adjusted earnings per share hit $1.55 per share, which is an increase of 36% year over year. For the year as a whole, revenue was up 20% over the prior year, earnings per share up 41%. And this is driven primarily by changing methods in how people are paying at the check stand or how people are paying in that checkout service online. We are seeing it go more and more towards card-based services. We've seen that for years now online, but it's starting to shift away a little bit more from certain other payment platforms, go towards cards. Now what you're seeing in store is a lot of it mirroring what you were seeing online. Like with Amazon gross merchandise volume, where again they calculate total transactional sales, including those from the third-party seller, MasterCard and other payment providers have what's called gross dollar volume. Basically, this is the amount of payments that they're processing or the amount of dollars that cross their payment platforms over a set period of time. Expanding this would be their number one priority then, because this is, after all, how they're bringing in income. We'll abbreviate it GDV. Well, globally for MasterCard, GDV was up 14% versus last year's same period. And in the U.S. alone, GDV was up 10% for MasterCard, telling us two things. Fewer people are using cash, and the merchandise economy was indeed strong in the fourth quarter. So a little bit of both on that front. Before we delve too far into MasterCard's operations, we have to preface with how important it can be to look at companies that aren't directly involved with retail. You might be asking us, why are we talking about a credit card company on a retail podcast? Well, companies like this, companies like retail real estate companies, companies that are tangentially involved with retail, we've also talked about distributors and supply chain managers in the past, they can give us valuable insights into the pulse of the retail economy. Transactions and transaction size, incredibly important figures that payment systems have a unique ability to evaluate. And we've talked with companies like Cardlytics, for example, in the past, as far as how we can get some of that data to better analyze the retail landscape. And it's the same figures we look at, honestly, when we're looking at a retailer's same-store sales, is the number of payments that are processed and the amount of the payments that are processed. Also, we should note for all of the news about the inevitable slowing economy, especially with the government shutdown that's captured a lot of headlines lately, and all the news about slowing mall traffic that we say you may not be as pronounced as what some of those news stories suggest, but what better way to measure what's actually happening than to look at one of the biggest consumer-facing payment processors? And that's exactly what we're doing here. And what we saw from MasterCard is an increase in volumes, and generally that means an increase also in retail sales traffic.
That's exactly right. Now, if we do look back into their most recent quarter, we see that $1.55 trillion in payments crossed their platform. I'll say it again, $1.55 trillion, $1.42 trillion last year. So just when you thought $1.42 trillion was a lot of money, well, they upped that by a significant amount this quarter. Those are a lot of global transactions for MasterCard and a lot to be responsible for. If you think about the fact that all of that money is crossing their platform or platforms in one way or another, that's a lot of responsibility. But one reason why this space is so hard to get into and take meaningful market share out of, something companies like Square have had a battle with here in the recent past, is because of safety and security measures. And we'll get into those initiatives with MasterCard in just a little bit. But when banks and retailers sign on to have exclusive cards backed by MasterCard, they are not only inheriting the brand and the security for their customers that is well known by MasterCard. I sound like a MasterCard salesperson, but I assure you, we are just speaking the truth here. They have a massive secure platform, but they are potentially getting access to the treasure troves too. Think about those retailers who want constant consumer data. And guess what? Data is exactly what MasterCard has been mining, and it is what they've been selling. For example, we were able to analyze recently the holiday sales trends through MasterCard Spending Pulse Survey, which is existent because of the data, and where we could easily break down some of the most talked about categories of late, namely toys and groceries. Groceries because it's a hyper-competitive space, razor-thin margins, but it is extremely high in terms of evolution as of late. You think of the curbside pickup service and all of that competition as far as who's going to win out that particular market share in any given quarter. talk about Walmart, talk about Costco, Target, and all of their initiatives really come together to try to take that market share. And then toys, think about the exit of Toys R Us. Where did those toy sales go? And you can see a lot of that through MasterCard sales data. So as added services, they are able to provide retailers some insights they may not otherwise get to their current locations. If you think about this, if a retailer wants to expand, take Aldi's Bargain Outlet, for example. Yes, they do sell new merchandise, but it's merchandise that is not as new or as trending as maybe some other more high-profile retailers. They're entering into new markets aggressively now, especially with the Toys R Us exit here over the last couple of years. And so you see that even though some retailers have access to their own sales data in the regions they currently do business, a company like Aldi's that is looking to transfer business or open business in an entirely new state needs to see what's hot in that particular market, because no two states are alike and no two demographic areas are alike either. And so you're looking at all of these different data points that MasterCard now has. MasterCard can hand over pretty much all of this data related to different geographical areas, and a retailer may be eyeing not only expansion, but also expansion in terms of their own area. So if they've been doing business in a particular area and want to expand their store count in a certain metropolitan area, any amount of data is extremely important. To say that one location sells a lot of groceries proportionate to the rest of your product selection, that may not have that much relevance to where you want to open. So also some high-level trends may be easier to spot for some retailers. If you think about this too, you know your current business. You know exactly what you're selling and how much of it and what you're comping. If you're a retailer, take Sam's Club, for example, in this scenario, you know what you're trending year over year in each particular category. However, you may be missing some high-level trends altogether. Think about a few years ago before Sam's Club and Costco started adopting organic merchandise. Well, if you don't have a lot of organic merchandise, you can't see how well it's comping. So this is another trend that they may be able to purchase from MasterCard to see that, oh, wait, in other stores such as Whole Foods and such as Kroger, their organic selection has tripled over the last 5 years, and maybe we need to adopt some of that new product selection ourselves. So these are data points that you sort of have to think outside the box for in order to see their relevance and in order to see their true value. A lot of these ancillary services are hidden from the public as we look through their investor relations page. And however, on their income statement, MasterCard's income statement under other revenues, we can see that service revenues were actually up more by a percentage increase than GDV. And for the company, that is massive for them. And it's going to be a logical investment as they move and focus more on data mining going forward. So in 2015, they bought Applied Predictive Technologies for $600 million, basically just touched the surface with what they were already doing. But let's remember back to our coverage on one of the most influential grocers, again in Kroger, where they bought analytics firm 8451 in 2015 for an unreported amount of money. But in that time, reportedly, it has paid dividends for that company. So we're talking about an acquisition 3.5 years ago for Kroger that has already paid dividends. Imagine what Applied Predictive Technologies has done for MasterCard. MasterCard's other revenues category, by the way, other revenues in quotation marks, hit a record $996 million. So that data, whether you like it or not, is extremely valuable for the top and bottom line for the company.
Speaking of spending pulse here, their data shows a 4.8% increase in retail spending in their fiscal fourth quarter. This would be slightly less than the mid 5% range we've seen for the last few months of 2018. Like with other estimates, this 4.8% number excluded fuel purchases. Once again, important to have this data because it tempers our expectations of some of the other data points that we're seeing out there. Kind of paints a more complete picture of the retail landscape, if you will. The UK, by the way, saw a 3.5% boost in retail sales according to the same survey, so slightly less than what you saw in the United States. MasterCard has the benefit of being so large and geographically diversified, but it can also be a curse as far as we're concerned. Listening to the earnings call, much of the call discussed headwinds in parts of Asia and even Northern Europe, a lot of headwinds as well in some developing markets that are kind of beginning to fold in card purchasing across their retail platforms. Again, because we're largely an American retail podcast, a lot of this didn't necessarily apply to what we wanted to see or what we were looking for. But again, co-branded partnerships have been a major driver for their core business. They recently secured partnerships with Kroger and L.L. Bean. Cabela's also in the pipeline and set for completion in the next couple of months. Much of their new business, whether from retailers or banks like Citigroup, Capital One, or HSBC, for those, they're pushing out contactless cards. They see commitments for roughly 65% of consumer cards to be transitioned or initiated as contactless cards over the next 2 years. Of course, you see a number of ad campaigns really pushing the contactless card technology. Target and CVS, for two retailers, have both told MasterCard that they want the technology embedded in their stores. Now, in theory, contactless cards have benefits in safety and security and longevity. They can store more data, won't need a strip that can wear out. And one of the reasons why you've seen it go to that chip technology there, but even chips wear out. There have been criticisms also in that pins are not still looked at as a requirement with the contactless cards, like what Target now has with their chip and pin system in store. But regardless, one has to applaud the proactiveness with the dialogue between banks, retailers, and all stakeholders when it comes to ease of use and user security. They certainly have the resources for R&D. Should be investing while they're ahead, so to speak. And remember, it hasn't always been this nice, the relationship between banks, retailers, and these card companies. And in fact, the relationship between retailers and card companies at several times over the past couple of years alone has been frazzled and fragmented. Now, the phrase long term came up a multitude of times on the earnings call as leadership wanted to frame their business as one that's being built on the foundation of a changing, more globalized world. That didn't stop them from talking about 2019 or the short term and what they expect from the macroeconomic vantage point. They expect to see strong demand for goods and services. They did say, though, there is some moderation with their forecast, almost like a Fed statement where a lot of vagueness and caveats and hedging leave you less confident about the year to come just because of the language that they're talking in. And lastly, if we had one takeaway from MasterCard's earnings, it would be that they are consistent with all statements pertaining to market share increases in every category they currently do business. And they're not acquiring companies and letting them sit around. They're funneling resources into their acquisitions to make them coexist with the systems in place around them. Truly, if you will, an example of that buzzword, synergy at work. Now, shares this Monday finished at $214.91, price to earnings ratio of 38, but this is a multiple that has more or less been associated with the company since its impressive 5-year run-up started.
As always, we may have a position in or against companies we discuss on the podcast. Do not invest in stocks solely on the input of the podcast hosts.
We reach the final segment of the Retail Focus podcast, a segment we call Looking Ahead, where each Leighton and I look ahead to a story we're keeping an eye on for the next week, month, or year. In the case of Leighton, this is a story that has been brewing for the last couple of years, but might come to a head this year.
My looking ahead has to do with a company that you targeted a couple years ago as a company that may be faltering in the near future. This company is H&M. It's owned and headquartered in Sweden. They have over 4,500 locations, but news this week came out about some financial woes the company's been having. So while overall revenues are up for the company, and they have been expanding rather aggressively throughout the United States and internationally, their operating margins, sort of a tale of the last couple of years, have been decreasing. Gross profit for 2018 was around 52.7% of sales, but it's not the number they want to see it at. And so you really have to look at the company and how they're performing. And I think this is sort of a tale of fashion because they have grown so much. They're popularized. People love them. But because of that, because so many people are enamored with this brand, it sort of loses its luster. And I think that's what's happened here. So they're talking about closing, potentially shuttering 160 stores because of that profit slump. And I think overall, the main focus point for me was that management said they're looking to renegotiate up to 1,000 current store contracts, or as we call them here in the United States, lease agreement. So I'm extremely curious to see if they can secure those, what malls are going to be open to renegotiating with H&M, what malls are not going to be. But furthermore, I'm extremely interested in seeing how management, because they have been pretty transparent up to this point, are going to battle, or what their strategy is going to be going forward with a massive inventory pileup, because that inventory, it ends up being a roller coaster ride, a roller coaster that tends to go downward, because the more inventory you have, the more you have to mark down merchandise, the more you have to mark down merchandise, the lower your profits are going forward, the lower your profits are going forward. Guess what? You end up opening less stores in the future and you end up not being as aggressive. And because of that, I'm extremely curious to see if they roll out a different type of inventory, if they start attracting different customers. But for them, they've been extremely prominent as far as the fashion industry in the United States up to this point. There's not much more, in my opinion, in my humble opinion, that they can do in terms of social media. Their presence is known. So from here on out, I'm extremely curious to see if they end up closing more stores. However, if you do look at the number of stores they are expanding, it's some pretty neutral news. They tend to want to open around 170 to 180 for the prior statements they made for 2019. So it ends up being a wash. It ends up just being a headline that we're talking about here. But it's extremely important that they are at least closing stores. It's not just all about positive expansion for them. It's also about a little bit of downsizing and a little bit of right-sizing their store footprint, not necessarily only in North America, but also globally.
So one thing I'll note, Leighton was talking about a Swedish company there in H&M. I'm actually spending the week here in Detroit, Michigan, with a number of dual citizens between Sweden and the U.S. because I'll be handling play-by-play duties for the floorball world qualifiers between the U.S. and Canada. Just wanted to kind of self-promote there. That'll be on ESPN3 later in the week, Friday and Saturday, if you wanted to check that out. But as far as my looking ahead story, I'm also going to go with a bit of a personal bent here. Now, you might have noticed from the last several podcasts, if you're a regular listener, I've mentioned that I live in Colorado. And one thing I've noticed here recently in Colorado is a preponderance of natural grocer stores popping up in smaller Colorado markets. And so natural grocers, again, run by Vitamin Cottage, or owned by Vitamin Cottage, depending on how you choose to read it. They opened a store a few years back in Monument, Colorado. It's just north of Colorado Springs, got a population of around 20 to 30,000 people. Now, that wasn't in and of itself notable. There are a number of other larger retailers there, but recently, three of their last store openings, this spans over the past 3 months, have been in smaller mountain town markets. As small, in fact, as Salida, Colorado, that has a population of just a little over 5,000 people. And when you talk about a natural food store opening in a town of 5,000, you automatically think that may not be sustainable. And what's more is these stores are essentially the same square footage, the same square footprint as the stores they open up in larger markets. The reason I mention all of that is to say this. Natural Grocers is reporting earnings this week, this Thursday, and I'm not so interested in the earnings. I mean, we are interested in the earnings. We may even cover it on next week's podcast, but what I'm interested to hear on the earnings call when I listen in is this: how much they mention that push towards smaller markets, and if this is something they see as maybe a short-term trend as they kind of fill a need that they see in these few markets in the mountains, or if this becomes a larger trend for them where they open in smaller markets that previously didn't have a large or robust grocery presence outside of maybe a Walmart or a local grocer there. So I want to see if this is the rare retailer that goes back to the smaller markets rather than runs away from them. We'll see how they see the future of their stores in smaller markets on this earnings call, or at least I hope we do. That'll do it for us here on the Retail Focus Podcast. For Leighton, I'm Trent. Once again, check us out on Instagram and Twitter at Retail Podcast, and we'll be back at you 1 week from now with more retail good stuff.
This has been the Retail Focus Podcast. For more, visit our website at retailfocuspodcast.com and subscribe on iTunes or Stitcher. Follow us on Twitter at Retail Podcast.